The USDA became largely indistinguishable from the industries it was meant to police. President Reagan's first Secretary of Agriculture was in the hog business. His second was the president of the American Meat Institute, formerly known as the American Meat Packers Association. And his choice to run the USDA's Food Marketing and Inspection Service was a vice president of the National Cattlemen's Association. President Bush later appointed the president of the National Cattlemen's Association to the job. 2 months after the threat of deadly new outbreaks was outlined by the National Academy of Sciences, the USDA launched the Streamlined Inspection System for Cattle, SISC. The program was designed to reduce the presence of federal inspectors in the nation's slaughterhouses, allowing company employees to assume most of the food safety tasks. According to the Reagan administration, the Streamlined Inspection System for Cattle would help the USDA shrink its budget and deploy its manpower more efficiently. Freed from the hassles of continuous federal inspection, SISC also enabled meatpacking companies to increase their line speeds. Despite the fact that IBP and Morrell had just a year earlier been caught falsifying safety records and keeping two sets of injury logs, the meatpacking industry was given the authority to inspect its own meat. SISC was launched in 1988 as a pilot program at five major slaughterhouses that supplied about one-fifth of the beef consumed in the United States. The USDA hoped that, within a decade, the new system would extend nationwide and that the number of federal meat inspectors would be cut by half. A 1992 USDA study of the Streamlined Inspection System for Cattle concluded that beef produced under the program was no dirtier than beef produced at slaughterhouses fully staffed by federal inspectors. But the accuracy of that study was thrown into doubt by the revelation that meatpacking firms had sometimes been told in advance when USDA investigators would be arriving at SISC slaughterhouses. The Monfort Beef Plant in Greeley, Colorado, was one of the original participants in the program. According to federal inspectors there, the meat produced under the Streamlined Inspection System had never been filthier. At SISC slaughterhouses, visibly diseased animals, cattle infected with measles and tapeworms, covered with abscesses, were being slaughtered. Poorly trained company inspectors were allowing the shipment of beef contaminated with fecal material, hair, insects, metal shavings, urine, and vomit. The Streamlined Inspection System for Cattle was discontinued in 1993 following the Jack in the Box outbreak. Cutbacks in federal inspection seemed difficult to justify when hundreds of children had been made seriously ill by tainted hamburgers. Although the precise source of E. coli 0157H7 contamination was never identified, some of the beef used by Jack in the Box came from an SISC plant, a Monfort slaughterhouse. The meatpacking industry's immediate reaction to the outbreak was an attempt to shift the blame elsewhere. As children continued to be hospitalized after eating Jack in the Box hamburgers, J. Patrick Boyle, the head of the American Meat Institute, said, "This recent outbreak sheds light on a nationwide problem, inconsistent information about proper cooking temperatures for hamburger." The meat industry's allies at the USDA also seemed remarkably laissez-faire, noting that the contaminated hamburger patties had not violated any federal standards. According to Dr. Russell Cross, head of the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, the presence of bacteria in raw meat, including E. coli 0157H7, although undesirable, is unavoidable and not cause for condemnation of the product. Members of the newly elected Clinton administration disagreed. Dr. Cross, a Bush appointee, resigned. On September 29, 1993, his replacement, Michael R. Taylor, announced that E. coli 0157H7 would henceforth be considered an illegal adulterant, that no ground beef contaminated with it could be sold, and that the USDA would begin random microbial testing to remove it from the nation's food supply. The American Meat Institute immediately filed a lawsuit in federal court to prevent the USDA from testing any ground beef for E. coli 0157H7. Judge James R. Rowland, a conservative and a cattleman, dismissed the meatpacking industry's arguments and allowed the testing to proceed. While the meatpacking industry sought to block implementation of a science-based inspection system, the owner of the Jack in the Box chain, Foodmaker Incorporated, struggled to recover from the bad publicity surrounding the outbreak. Robert Nugent, the president of Foodmaker, had waited a week before acknowledging that Jack in the Box bore some responsibility for the illnesses. His first instinct had been to blame the chain's ground beef supplier and Washington state health officials. He claimed that Jack in the Box had never received a thorough explanation of why hamburgers needed to be fully cooked. Nugent soon recruited Jody Powell, President Jimmy Carter's former press secretary, to help improve the company's image, and hired David M. Thino, a prominent food scientist, to prevent future outbreaks. Thino had previously helped Foster Farms, a family-owned poultry processor in California, eliminate most of the salmonella from its birds. He was a strong advocate of hazard analysis and critical control points, HACCP programs, embracing a food safety philosophy that the National Academy of Sciences had promoted for years. The essence of a HACCP program is prevention. It attempts to combine scientific analysis with common sense. The most vulnerable steps in a food production system are identified and then monitored. Stacks and stacks of records are kept in order to follow what went where. Thino quickly realized after arriving at Jack in the Box that the chain relied upon the safety standards of its suppliers instead of imposing its own. He created the first HACCP plan in the fast food industry, a farm-to-fork policy that scrutinized threats to food safety at every level of production and distribution. Assuring Jack in the Box customers that their food was safe not only seemed the right thing to do, it seemed essential for the chain's survival. In the years since the Jack in the Box outbreak, David Thino has emerged as a fast food maverick, applauded by consumer groups and considered the antichrist, he says, by many in the meatpacking industry. Thino insisted that every Jack in the Box manager attend a food safety course, that every refrigerated delivery truck have a record-keeping thermometer mounted inside it, that every kitchen grill be calibrated to ensure an adequate cooking temperature, and that every grill person use tongs to handle hamburger patties instead of bare hands. An almost fanatical devotion to microbial testing, however, became the key to Thino's food safety program. He discovered that the levels of contamination varied enormously in ground beef supplied by different meatpacking companies. Some slaughterhouses did a fine job, others were adequate, and a few were appalling. The companies that manufactured hamburger patties for Jack in the Box were required to test their beef every 15 minutes for a wide range of dangerous microbes, including E. coli 0157H7. Slaughterhouses that continued to ship bad meat were eliminated as suppliers. Jack in the Box now buys all of its ground beef from two companies, SSI, a subsidiary of the J.R. Simplot Company, and Texas American, a subsidiary of the family-owned American Food Service Corporation. Thino gave me a tour of the Texas American plant in Fort Worth that makes hamburger patties for Jack in the Box. We were accompanied by the plant manager, Tim Biella. Much of Biella's work involved testing things repeatedly and maintaining records of the tests. "You can't manage what you don't measure," he said more than once. His records contain not only the date and time when a case of hamburger patties was produced, but also which employees worked that shift, which slaughterhouse provided that beef, and which feedlots sent cattle to the slaughterhouse that day. The hamburger patty plant looked new and clean. I saw huge vats of beef scraps, some shipped all the way from Australia, stacked high in a cooler. The beef was dumped from the vats into shiny stainless steel machines. It was ground into fine particles by giant augers, mixed into exact proportions of lean meat and fat, stamped into patties, perforated, frozen, passed through metal detectors, and then sealed in plastic wrap. The frozen hamburger patties that came out of the machines looked like little pink waffles. David Thino would like the meatpacking industry to adopt a system of performance-based grading. Slaughterhouses that produced consistently clean meat would receive a grade A. Plants that performed moderately well would receive a grade B, and so on. Microbial testing would determine the grades, and the marketplace would reward companies that ranked highest. Plants that earned only a C or a D would have to do better, or stick to making dog food. Some people in the fast food industry resent the idea that Jack in the Box, which was involved in such a large outbreak of food poisoning, has assumed the mantle of leadership on the issue of food safety. Thino's support for tough food safety legislation in California made him unpopular with the state's restaurant association. The meatpacking industry is not fond of him either. Thino says that the industry's long-standing resistance to microbial testing is a form of denial. If you don't know about a problem, he explained, then you don't have to deal with it. He thinks that the problem of E. coli 0157H7 contamination in ground beef can be solved. He has an optimistic faith in the power of science and reason. If you put in a scorekeeping system and profile these meatpacking companies, Thino says, you can fix this problem. You can actually fix this problem in 6 months. This is a matter of will, not technology. Despite the meatpacking industry's claims, the solution need not be enormously expensive. The entire Jack in the Box food safety program raises the cost of the chain's ground beef by about 1 penny per pound. Surrounded by parents whose children had died after eating hamburgers tainted with E. coli 0157H7, President Clinton announced in July of 1996 that the USDA would finally adopt a science-based meat inspection system. Under the new regulations, every slaughterhouse and processing plant in the United States would, by the end of the decade, have to implement a government-approved HACCP plan and submit meat to the USDA for microbial testing. Clinton's announcement depicted the changes as the most sweeping reform of the federal government's food safety policies since the days of Theodore Roosevelt. The USDA plan, however, had been significantly watered down during negotiations with the meatpacking industry and Republican members of Congress. The new system would shift many food safety tasks to company employees. The records compiled by those employees, unlike the reports traditionally written by federal inspectors, would not be available to the public through the Freedom of Information Act. And meatpacking plants would not be required to test for E. coli 0157H7, a pathogen whose discovery might lead to immediate condemnation of their meat. Instead, they could test for other bacteria as a broad measure of fecal contamination levels. The results of those tests would not have to be revealed to the government, and meat containing whatever organisms the tests found could still be sold to the public. Many federal meat inspectors opposed the Clinton administration's new system, arguing that it greatly diminished their authority to detect and remove contaminated meat. Today, the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service is demoralized and understaffed. In 1978, before the first known outbreak of E. coli 0157H7, the USDA had 12,000 meat inspectors. Now, it has about 7,500. The federal inspectors I interviewed felt under enormous pressure from their USDA superiors not to slow down the line speeds at slaughterhouses. "A lot of us are feeling beaten down," one inspector told me. "Job openings at the service are going unfilled for months." Federal inspectors warned that the new HACCP plans are only as good as the people running them, and that in the wrong hands, HACCP stands for have a cup of coffee, and pray. The Hudson Foods plant in Columbus, Nebraska, was operating under a HACCP plan in 1997 when it shipped 35 million pounds of potentially tainted meat. We give no serious validity to company-generated records, a longtime federal inspector told me. There's a lot of falsification going on. His view was confirmed by other inspectors and by former meatpacking workers who were in charge of quality control. According to Judy, a former QC at one of IBP's largest slaughterhouses, the HACCP plan at her plant was terrific on paper, but much less impressive in real life. Senior management cared much more about production than food safety. The quality control department was severely understaffed. A single QC had to keep an eye on two production lines simultaneously. I had to check the sterilizer temperature. I had to check the cryovac temperature. I had to look at packaging. I had to note the vats. Did they have foreign objects in them or not? I had to keep an eye on workers so they wouldn't cheat, Judy said. I was overwhelmed with work. It was just impossible to keep up with it all. She routinely falsified her checklist, as did the other QCs. The HACCP plan would have been fantastic if three people had been employed doing her job. There was no way that one person could get all the tasks on the list properly done. Though the meatpacking industry has fought almost every federal effort to mandate food safety, it has also invested millions of dollars in new equipment to halt the spread of dangerous pathogens. IBP, for example, has installed expensive steam pasteurization cabinets at all of its beef slaughterhouses. Sides of beef enter the new contraption, which blow-dries them, bathes them in 220-degree steam for 8 seconds, and then sprays them with cold water. When used properly, steam pasteurization cabinets can kill off most of the E. coli 0157H7 and reduce the amount of bacteria on the meat surface by as much as 90%. But an IBP internal corporate memo from 1997 suggests that the company's large investment in such technologies has been motivated less by a genuine concern for the health and well-being of American consumers than by other considerations. We have been informed that carcasses in your plant are occasionally being delayed for extended periods of time on the USDA outrail for final disposition, up to 6 hours, the IBP memo began. It was sent by the company's vice president for quality control and food safety to the plant manager at the Lexington, Nebraska slaughterhouse. It warned that the longer a carcass remains on the outrail, the harder it is to clean. With every passing minute, bacteria grows more firmly attached and difficult to kill. This delayed carcass deposition, the memo emphasized, is of concern and is cause for extraordinary actions regarding such affected carcasses. When carcasses sat for half an hour on the outrail, supervisors were instructed to find the cause for the delay. When carcasses sat for an hour, supervisors were told to spray the meat with a special acid wash. Carcasses that sat for longer than 2 hours, that were at highest risk for bacterial contamination, were not to be destroyed or sent to rendering or set aside for processing into pre-cooked meats. Such carcasses, IBP's top food safety executive advised, are to be designated for outside, non-IBP carcass sale. The dirtiest meat was to be shipped out and sold for public consumption, but not with an IBP label on it. Instead of focusing on the primary causes of meat contamination, the feed being given to cattle, the overcrowding at feedlots, the poor sanitation at slaughterhouses, excessive line speeds, poorly trained workers, the lack of stringent government oversight, the meatpacking industry and the USDA are now advocating an exotic technological solution to the problem of foodborne pathogens. They want to irradiate the nation's meat. Irradiation is a form of bacterial birth control, pioneered in the 1960s by the U.S. Army and by NASA. When microorganisms are zapped with low levels of gamma rays or X-rays, they are not killed, but their DNA is disrupted, and they cannot reproduce. Irradiation has been used for years on some imported spices and domestic poultry. Most irradiating facilities have concrete walls that are 6 feet thick. Employing cobalt-60 or cesium-137, a waste product from nuclear weapons plants and nuclear power plants, to create highly charged radioactive beams. A new technique, developed by the Titan Corporation, uses conventional electricity and an electronic accelerator instead of radioactive isotopes. Titan devised its SureBeam irradiation technology during the 1980s while conducting research for the Star Wars anti-missile program. The American Medical Association and the World Health Organization have declared that irradiated foods are safe to eat. Widespread introduction of the process has thus far been impeded, however, by a reluctance among consumers to eat things that have been exposed to radiation. According to current USDA regulations, irradiated meat must be identified with a special label and with a radura, the internationally recognized symbol of radiation. The Beef Industry Food Safety Council, whose members include the meatpacking and fast food giants, has asked the USDA to change its rules and make the labeling of irradiated meat completely voluntary. The meatpacking industry is also working hard to get rid of the word irradiation, much preferring the phrase cold pasteurization. One slaughterhouse engineer that I interviewed, who has helped to invent some of the most sophisticated food safety equipment now being used, told me that from a purely scientific point of view, irradiation is safe and effective. But he is concerned about the introduction of highly complex electromagnetic and nuclear technology into slaughterhouses with a largely illiterate, non-English-speaking workforce. These are not the type of people you want working on that level of equipment, he says. He also worries that the widespread use of irradiation might encourage meatpackers to speed up the kill floor and spray shit everywhere. Stephen Bjerkley, the former editor of Meat and Poultry, opposes irradiation on similar grounds. He thinks it'll reduce pressure on the meatpacking industry to make fundamental and necessary changes in their production methods, allowing unsanitary practices to continue. I don't want to be served irradiated feces along with my meat. For years, some of the most questionable ground beef in the United States was purchased by the USDA and then distributed to school cafeterias throughout the country. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, the USDA chose meat suppliers for its national school lunch program on the basis of the lowest price, without imposing additional food safety requirements. The cheapest ground beef was not only the most likely to be contaminated with pathogens, but also the most likely to contain pieces of spinal cord, bone, and gristle left behind by automated meat recovery systems, contraptions that squeeze the last shreds of meat off bones. A 1983 investigation by NBC News said that the Cattle King Packing Company, at the time the USDA's largest supplier of ground beef for school and a supplier to Wendy's, routinely processed cattle that were already dead before arriving at its plant, hid diseased cattle from inspectors, and mixed rotten meat that had been returned by customers into packages of hamburger meat. Cattle King's facilities were infested with rats and cockroaches. Rudy Butch Stanko, the owner of the company, was later tried and convicted for selling tainted meat to the federal government. He had been convicted just 2 years earlier on similar charges. That earlier felony conviction had not prevented him from supplying one quarter of the ground beef served in the USDA school lunch program. More recently, an 11-year-old boy became seriously ill in April of 1998 after eating a hamburger at his elementary school in Danielsville, Georgia. Tests of the ground beef, which had been processed by the Bauer Meat Company, confirmed the presence of E. coli 015787. Bauer Meat's processing plant in Ocala, Florida, was so filthy that on August 12, 1998, the USDA withdrew its inspectors, a highly unusual move. Frank Bauer, the company's owner, committed suicide the next day. The USDA later declared Bauer's meat products unfit for human consumption, ordering that roughly 6 million pounds be detained. Nearly a third of the meat had already been shipped to school districts in North Carolina and Georgia, U.S. military bases, and prisons. Around the same time, a dozen children in Findlay, Washington, were sickened by E. coli 015787. 11 of them had eaten undercooked beef tacos at their school cafeteria. The 12th, a 2-year-old, was most likely infected by one of the other children. The company that had supplied the USDA with the taco meat, Northern States Beef, a subsidiary of ConAgra, had in the previous 18 months been cited for 171 critical food safety violations at its facilities. A critical violation is one likely to cause serious contamination and to harm consumers. Northern States Beef was also linked to a 1994 outbreak of E. coli 015787 in Nebraska that sickened 18 people. Nevertheless, the USDA continued to do business with the ConAgra subsidiary, buying about 20 million pounds of its meat for use in American schools. During the 1990s, the federal government, which is supposed to ensure food safety, applied standards to the meat it purchased for schools that were much less stringent than the standards applied by the fast food industry, which is responsible for much of the current threat to food safety. Having played a central role in the creation of a meatpacking system that can spread bacterial contamination far and wide, the fast food chains are now able to avoid many of the worst consequences. Much like Jack in the Box, the leading chains have in recent years forced their suppliers to conduct frequent tests for E. coli 015787 and other pathogens. More importantly, the enormous buying power of the fast food giants has given them access to some of the cleanest ground beef. The meatpacking industry is now willing to perform the sort of rigorous testing for fast food chains that it refuses to do for the general public. Anyone who brings raw ground beef into his or her kitchen today must regard it as a potential biohazard, one that may carry an extremely dangerous microbe, infectious at an extremely low dose. The current high levels of ground beef contamination, combined with the even higher levels of poultry contamination, have led to some bizarre findings. A series of tests conducted by Charles Gerba, a microbiologist at the University of Arizona, discovered far more fecal bacteria in the average American kitchen sink than on the average American toilet seat. According to Gerba, you'd be better off eating a carrot stick that fell in your toilet than one that fell in your sink. Although the fast food chains have belatedly made food safety a priority, their production and distribution systems remain vulnerable to newly emerging foodborne pathogens. A virus that carries the gene to produce Shiga toxins is now infecting previously harmless strains of E. coli. Dr. David Acheson, an associate professor of medicine at Tufts University Medical School, believes the spread of that virus is being encouraged by the indiscriminate use of antibiotics in cattle feed. In addition to E. coli 015787, approximately 60 to 100 other mutant E. coli organisms now produce Shiga toxins. Perhaps a third of them cause illnesses in human beings. The CDC now estimates that roughly 37,000 Americans suffer food poisoning each year from non-0157 strains of E. coli. About 1,000 people are hospitalized, and about 25 die. No matter how well executed the HACCP plan, no matter how highly automated the grills, no matter how many bursts of gamma radiation are fired at the meat, the safety of the food at any restaurant ultimately depends upon the workers in its kitchen. Dr. Patricia Griffin, one of the CDC's leading experts on E. coli 015787, believes that food safety classes should be mandatory for fast food workers. We place our lives in their hands, she says, in the same way we entrust our lives to the training of airline pilots. Griffin worries that a low-paid, unskilled workforce composed of teenagers and recent immigrants may not always be familiar with proper food handling procedures. Dr. Griffin has good reason to worry. A 1997 undercover investigation by KCBS-TV in Los Angeles videotaped local restaurant workers sneezing into their hands while preparing food, licking salad dressing off their fingers, picking their noses, and flicking their cigarettes into meals about to be served. In May of 2000, three teenage employees at a Burger King in Scottsville, New York, were arrested for putting spit, urine, and cleaning products such as Easy Off Oven Cleaner and Comet with bleach into the food. They had allegedly tampered with the Burger King food for 8 months, and it was served to thousands of customers until a fellow employee informed the management. The teenage fast food workers I met in Colorado Springs, Colorado, told me other horror stories. The safety of the food seemed to be determined more by the personality of the manager on duty than by the written policies of the chain. Many workers would not eat anything at their restaurant unless they'd made it themselves. A Taco Bell employee said that food dropped on the floor was often picked up and served. An Arby's employee told me that one kitchen worker never washed his hands at work after doing engine repairs on his car. And several employees at the same McDonald's restaurant in Colorado Springs independently provided details about a cockroach infestation in the milkshake machine, and about armies of mice that urinated and defecated on headed on hamburger rolls left out to thaw in the kitchen every night. Global realization. As the fast food industry has grown more competitive in the United States, the major chains have looked to overseas markets for their future growth. The McDonald's Corporation recently used a new phrase to describe its hopes for foreign conquest: global realization. A decade ago, McDonald's had about 3,000 restaurants outside the United States. Today, it has about 15,000 restaurants in more than 117 foreign countries. It currently opens about 5 new restaurants every day, and at least 4 of them are overseas. Within the next decade, Jack Greenberg, the company's chief executive, hopes to double the number of McDonald's. The chain earns the majority of its profits outside the United States, as does KFC. McDonald's now ranks as the most widely recognized brand in the world, more familiar than Coca-Cola. The values, tastes, and industrial practices of the American fast food industry are being exported to every corner of the globe, helping to create a homogenized international culture that sociologist Benjamin R. Barber has labeled McWorld. The fast food chains have become totems of Western economic development. They are often the first multinationals to arrive when a country has opened its markets, serving as the avant-garde of American franchising. 15 years ago, when McDonald's opened its first restaurant in Turkey, no other foreign franchisor did business there. Turkey now has hundreds of franchise outlets, including 7-Eleven, Nutrislim, Remax Real Estate, Mailboxes, etc., and Zbart Tidy Car. Support for the growth of franchising has even become part of American foreign policy. The U.S. State Department now publishes detailed studies of overseas franchise opportunities and runs a Gold Key program at many of its embassies to help American franchisers find overseas partners. The anthropologist Yunjiang Yan has noted that in the eyes of Beijing consumers, McDonald's represents Americana and the promise of modernization. Thousands of people waited patiently for hours to eat at the city's first McDonald's in 1992. 2 years later, when a McDonald's opened in Kuwait, the line of cars waiting at the drive-through window extended for 7 miles. Around the same time, a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant in Saudi Arabia's holy city of Mecca set new sales records for the chain, earning $200,000 in a single week during Ramadan, the Muslim holy month. In Brazil, McDonald's has become the nation's largest private employer. The fast food chains are now imperial fiefdoms, sending their emissaries far and wide. Classes at McDonald's Hamburger University in Oak Park, Illinois, are taught in 20 different languages. Few places on earth seem too distant or too remote for the Golden Arches. In 1986, the Tahiti Tourism Promotion Board ran an ad campaign featuring pristine beaches and the slogan, "Sorry, no McDonald's." A decade later, one opened in Papeete, the Tahitian capital, bringing hamburgers and fries to a spot thousands of miles across the Pacific from the nearest cattle ranches or potato fields. As the fast food chains have moved overseas, they've been accompanied by their major suppliers. In order to diminish fears of American imperialism, the chains try to purchase as much food as possible in the countries where they operate. Instead of importing food, they import entire systems of agricultural production. 7 years before McDonald's opened its first restaurant in India, the company began to establish a supply network there, teaching Indian farmers how to grow iceberg lettuce with seeds specially developed for the nation's climate. A McDonald's restaurant is just the window of a much larger system comprising an extensive food chain, running right up to the farms, one of the company's Indian partners told a foreign journalist. In 1987, ConAgra took over the Elders Company in Australia, the largest beef company in the country that exports more beef than any other in the world. Over the past decade, Cargill and IBP have gained control of the beef industry in Canada. Cargill has established large-scale poultry operations in China and Thailand. Tyson Foods is planning to build chicken processing plants in China, Indonesia, and the Philippines. ConAgra's Lamb Weston division now manufactures frozen French fries in Holland, India, and Turkey. McCain, the world's biggest French fry producer, operates 50 processing plants scattered across four continents. In order to supply McDonald's, J.R. Simplot began to grow russet Burbank potatoes in China, opening that nation's first French fry factory in 1993. A few years ago, Simplot bought 11 processing plants in Australia, aiming to increase sales in the East Asian market. He also purchased a 3-million-acre ranch in Australia, where he hopes to run cattle, raise vegetables, and grow potatoes. "It's a great little country," Simplot says, "and there's nobody in it." As in the United States, the fast food companies have targeted their foreign advertising and promotion at a group of consumers with the fewest attachments to tradition, young children. Kids are the same regarding the issues that affect the all-important stages of their development, a top executive at the Geppetto Group told the audience at a recent Kid Power conference. And they apply to any kid in Berlin, Beijing, or Brooklyn. The Kid Power conference, attended by marketing executives from Burger King and Nickelodeon, among others, was held at the Disneyland outside of Paris. In Australia, where the number of fast food restaurants roughly tripled during the 1990s, a survey found that half of the nation's 9 and 10-year-olds thought that Ronald McDonald knew what kids should eat. At a primary school in Beijing, Yun Zhang Yan found that all of the children recognized an image of Ronald McDonald. The children told Yan they liked Uncle McDonald because he was funny, gentle, kind, and he understood children's hearts. Coca-Cola is now the favorite drink among Chinese children, and McDonald's serves their favorite food. Simply eating at a McDonald's in Beijing seems to elevate a person's social status. The idea that you are what you eat has been enthusiastically promoted for years by Den Fujita, the eccentric billionaire who brought McDonald's to Japan 3 decades ago. "If we eat McDonald's hamburgers and potatoes for 1,000 years, Fujita once promised his countrymen, "we will become taller, our skin will become white, and our hair will be blonde." The impact of fast food is readily apparent in Germany, which has become one of McDonald's most profitable overseas markets. Germany is not only the largest country in Europe, but also the most Americanized. Although the four Allied powers occupied it after World War II, the Americans exerted the greatest lasting influence, perhaps because their nationalism was so inclusive and their nation so distant. Children in West German schools were required to study English, facilitating the spread of American pop culture. Young people who sought to distance themselves from the wartime behavior of their parents found escape in American movies, music, and novels. For a child growing up in the up-and-up turmoil of post-war Berlin, the Americans were angels, Christa Mercker, a Berlin filmmaker, wrote in an essay on post-war Germany's infatuation with the United States. Anything from them was bigger and more wonderful than anything that preceded it. The United States and Germany fought against each other twice in the 20th century, but the enmity between them has often seemed less visceral than other national rivalries. The recent takeover of prominent American corporations, such as Chrysler, Random House, and RCA Records, by German companies provoked none of the public anger that was unleashed when Japanese firms bought much less significant American assets in the 1980s. Despite America's long-standing special relationship with Great Britain, the underlying cultural ties between the United States and Germany, though less obvious, are equally strong. Americans with German ancestors far outnumber those with English ancestors. Moreover, during the past century, both American culture and German culture have shown an unusually strong passion for science, technology, engineering, empiricism, social order, and efficiency. The electronic paper towel dispenser that I saw in a Munich men's room is the spiritual kin of the gas-powered ketchup dispensers at the McDonald's in Colorado Springs. The traditional German restaurant, serving schnitzel, bratwurst, knockwurst, sauerbraten, and large quantities of beer, is rapidly disappearing in Germany. Such establishments now account for less than one-third of the German food service market. Their high labor costs have for the most part been responsible for their demise, along with the declining popularity of schnitzel. McDonald's Deutschland Incorporated is by far the biggest restaurant company in Germany today, more than twice as large as the nearest competitor. It opened the first German McDonald's in 1971. At the beginning of the 1990s, it had 400 restaurants, and now it has more than 1,000. The company's main dish happens to be named after Hamburg, a German city where ground beef steaks were popular in the early 19th century. The hamburger was born when Americans added the bun. McDonald's Deutschland uses German potatoes for its fries and Bavarian dairy cows for its burgers. It sends Ronald McDonald into hospitals and schools. It puts new McDonald's restaurants in gas stations, railway stations, and airports. It battles labor unions. And according to Siegfried Pater, author of Zum Beispiel McDonald's, has repeatedly fired union sympathizers. The golden arches have become so commonplace in Germany that they seem almost invisible. You don't notice them unless you're looking for them or feeling hungry. One German McDonald's, however, stands out from the rest. It sits on a nondescript street in a new shopping complex not far from Dachau, the first concentration camp opened by the Nazis. The stores were built on fields where Dachau's inmates once did forced labor. Although the architecture of the shopping complex looks German and futuristic, the haphazard placement of the buildings on the land seems distinctively American. They would not seem out of place near an off-ramp of I-25 in Colorado. Across the street from the McDonald's, there's a discount supermarket. An auto parts store stands a few hundred yards from the other buildings, separated by fields that have not yet vanished beneath concrete. In 1997, protests were staged against the opening of a McDonald's so close to a concentration camp where gypsies, Jews, homosexuals, and political opponents of the Nazis were imprisoned, where Luftwaffe scientists performed medical experiments on inmates, and roughly 30,000 people died. The McDonald's Corporation denied that it was trying to profit from the Holocaust and said that the restaurant was at least a mile from the camp. After the curator of the Dachau Museum complained that McDonald's was distributing thousands of leaflets among tourists in the camp's parking lot, the company halted the practice. "Welcome to Dachau," said the leaflets, "and welcome to McDonald's." The McDonald's at Dachau is one-third of a mile from the entrance to the concentration camp. The day I went there, the restaurant was staging a Western Big Mac promotion. It was decorated in a Wild West theme, with paper placemats featuring a wanted poster of Butch Essity. The restaurant was full of mothers and small children. Teenagers dressed in Nikes, Levi's, and Tommy Hilfiger t-shirts sat in groups and smoked cigarettes. Turkish immigrants worked in the kitchen, 70s disco music played, and the red paper cups on everyone's tray said, "Always Coca-Cola." This McDonald's was in Dachau, but it could have been anywhere. Anywhere in the United States, anywhere in the world. Millions of other people at that very moment were standing at the same counter, ordering the same food from the same menu, food that tasted everywhere the same. The most surreal experience that I had during 3 years of research into fast food took place not at the top-secret Air Force base that got its Domino's pizzas delivered, not at the Flavor Factory off the New Jersey Turnpike, not at the Dachau McDonald's. It occurred on March 1, 1999, at the Mirage Hotel in Las Vegas. Like an epiphany, it revealed the strange power of fast food in the New World Order. The Mirage, with its five-story volcano, its shark tank, dolphin tank, indoor rainforest, lagoon saloon, DKNY boutique, and secret garden of Siegfried and Roy, is a fine place for the surreal. Even its name suggests the triumph of illusion over reality, a promise that you won't believe your eyes. On that day in March, as usual, Las Vegas was full of spectacles and name acts. George Carlin was at Bally's, and David Cassidy was at the MGM Grand. Starring in FX, a show billed as a high-tech journey through space and time. The History of Sex was at the Golden Nugget. And Mikhail Gorbachev, former president of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, winner of the Orders of Lenin, the Red Banner of Labor, and the Nobel Peace Prize, was at the Grand Ballroom of the Mirage, giving the keynote speech before a fast food convention. The convention and its setting were an ideal match. In many ways, Las Vegas is the fulfillment of social and economic trends now sweeping from the American West to the farthest reaches of the globe. Las Vegas is the fastest growing major city in the United States, an entirely man-made creation, a city that lives for the present, that has little connection to its surrounding landscape, that cares little about its own past. Nothing in Las Vegas is built to last. Hotels are routinely demolished as soon as they seem out of fashion, and the city limits seem as arbitrary as its location, with plastic bags and garbage littering the open land where the lawns end, the desert not far from the strip. Las Vegas began as an overnight camp for travelers going to California on the old Spanish Trail. It later became a ranching town, notable in the early 1940s, mainly for its rodeo, its Wild West tourist attractions, and a nightclub called the Apache Bar. The population was about 8,000. The subsequent growth of Las Vegas was made possible by the federal government, which spent billions of dollars to erect the Hoover Dam and build military bases near the city. The dam supplied water and electricity, while the bases provided the early casinos with customers. When authorities in Southern California cracked down on illegal gambling after World War II, the gamblers headed for Nevada. As in Colorado Springs, the real boom in Las Vegas began toward the end of the 1970s. Over the past 20 years, the population of Las Vegas has nearly tripled. Today there are few remaining traces of the city's cowboy past. Indeed, the global equation has been reversed. While the rest of the world builds Walmarts, Arby's, Taco Bells, and other outposts of Americana, Las Vegas has spent the past decade recreating the rest of the world. The fast food joints along the strip seem insignificant compared to the new monuments towering over them. Recreations of the Eiffel Tower, the Statue of Liberty, and the Sphinx, enormous buildings that evoke Venice, Paris, New York, Tuscany, medieval England, ancient Egypt and Rome, the Middle East, the South Seas. Las Vegas is now so contrived and artificial that it has become something authentic, a place unlike any other. The same forces that are homogenizing other cities have made Las Vegas even more unique. At the heart of Las Vegas is technology, machinery that cools the air, erupts the volcano, and powers the shimmering lights. Most important of all is the machinery that makes money for the casinos. While Las Vegas portrays itself as a freewheeling entrepreneurial town where anyone can come and strike it rich, life there is more tightly regulated, controlled, and monitored by hidden cameras than just about anywhere else in the United States. The city's principal industry is legally protected against the workings of the free market and operates according to strict rules laid down by the state. The Nevada Gaming Control Board determines not only who can own a casino, but who can enter one. In a town built on gambling, where fortunes were once earned with a roll of the dice, it's remarkable how little is now left to chance. Until the late 1960s, about three-quarters of a typical casino's profits came from table games, from poker, blackjack, baccarat, roulette. During the last 25 years, table games, which are supervised by dealers and offer gamblers the best odds, have been displaced by slot machines. Today, about two-thirds of a typical casino's profits now come from slots and video poker, machines that are precisely calibrated to take your money. They guarantee the casino a profit rate of as much as 20%, four times what a roulette wheel will bring. The latest slot machines are electronically connected to a central computer, allowing the casino to track the size of every bet and its outcome. The music, flashing lights, and sound effects emitted by these slots help disguise the fact that a small processor inside them is deciding with mathematical certainty how long you'll play before you lose. It's the ultimate consumer technology, designed to manufacture not a tangible product, but something much more elusive, a brief sense of hope. That is what Las Vegas really sells, the most brilliant illusion of all, a loss that feels like winning. Mikhail Gorbachev was in town to speak at the 26th Annual Chain Operators Exchange, a convention sponsored by the International Food Service Manufacturers Association. Executives from the major fast food companies had gathered to discuss, among other things, the latest labor-saving machinery and the prospects of someday employing a workforce that needed zero training. Representatives from the industry's leading suppliers, ConAgra, Munford, Simplot, and others, had come to sell their latest products. The grand ballroom at the Mirage was filled with hundreds of middle-aged white men in expensive business suits. They sat at long tables beneath crystal chandeliers, drinking coffee, greeting old friends, waiting for the morning program to begin. A few of them were obviously struggling to recover from whatever they'd done in Las Vegas the night before. On the surface, Mikhail Gorbachev seemed an odd choice to address a group so resolutely opposed to labor unions, minimum wages, and workplace safety rules. "Those who hope we shall move away from the socialist path will be greatly disappointed," Gorbachev had written in Perestroika, 1987, at the height of his power. He had never sought the dissolution of the Soviet Union and never renounced his fundamental commitment to Marxism-Leninism. He still believed in the class struggle and scientific socialism. But the fall of the Berlin Wall had thrown Gorbachev out of power and left him in a precarious financial condition. He was beloved abroad, yet despised in his own land. During Russia's 1996 presidential election, he received just 1% of the vote. The following year, he expressed great praise for America's leading fast food chain. And the merry clowns, the Big Mac signs, the colorful unique decorations, and ideal cleanliness, Gorbachev wrote in the foreword of To Russia with Fries, a memoir by a McDonald's executive, all of this complements the hamburgers whose great popularity is well-deserved. In December of 1997, Gorbachev appeared in a Pizza Hut commercial, following in the footsteps of Cindy Crawford and Ivana Trump. A group of patrons at a Moscow Pizza Hut thanked him in the ad for bringing the fast food chain to Russia and then shouted, "Hail to Gorbachev!" In response, Gorbachev saluted them by raising a slice of pizza. He reportedly earned $160,000 for his appearance in the 60-second spot, money earmarked for his non-profit foundation. A year later, Pizza Hut announced that it was pulling out of Russia as the country's economy collapsed, and Gorbachev told a German reporter that all my money is gone. For his hour-long speech at the Mirage, Gorbachev was promised a fee of $150,000 and the use of a private jet. The 26th annual Chain Operators Exchange officially opened with a video presentation of the national anthem. As the song boomed from speakers throughout the grand ballroom, two huge screens above the stage displayed a series of patriotic images: the Statue of Liberty, the Lincoln Memorial, amber waves of grain. In one of the morning's first speeches, an executive hailed the restaurant industry's record profits the previous year, adding, without irony, "As if things weren't good enough, consumers also dropped all pretense of wanting healthy food." An ongoing industry survey had found that public concerns about salt, fat, and food additives were at their lowest level since 1982 when the survey began. One more bit of news to justify the industry's current state of bliss. Robert Nugent, the head of Jack in the Box and honorary chairman of the 26th Annual Chain Operators Exchange, broke the cheery mood with an ominous, unsettling speech. He essentially accused critics of the fast food industry of being un-American. A growing number of groups who represent narrow social and political interests, Nugent warned, have set their sights on our industry in an effort to legislate behavioral change. Enjoying a great meal at a restaurant was the very essence of freedom, he declared, a ritual now being threatened by groups with an agenda that was anti-meat, anti-alcohol, anti-caffeine, anti-fat, anti-chemical additives, anti-horseradish, anti-non-dairy creamer. The media played a central role in helping these activist fearmongers, but the National Restaurant Association had recently launched a counterattack, working closely with journalists to dispel myths and gain better publicity. Nugent called upon the fast food executives to respond even more forcefully to their critics, people who today posed a real danger to our industry, and more broadly, to our way of life. Not long afterward, Mikhail Gorbachev appeared on stage and received a standing ovation. Here was the man who'd ended the Cold War, who'd brought political freedom to hundreds of millions, who'd opened vast new markets. At the age of 69, Gorbachev looked remarkably unchanged from his appearance during the Reagan years. His hair was white, but he seemed vigorous and strong, still capable of running a mighty empire. He spoke quickly in Russian and then waited patiently for the translator to catch up. His delivery was full of energy and passion. "I like America," Gorbachev said with a broad smile, "and I like American people." He wanted to give the audience a sense of what was happening in Russia today. Few people in the United States seemed to care much about events in Russia, a dangerous state of affairs. He asked the crowd to learn about his country, to form partnerships and make investments there. "You must have a lot of money," Gorbachev said. "Send it to Russia." A few minutes into Gorbachev's speech, the audience began to lose interest. he had badly misjudged the crowd. His speech might have been a success at the Council on Foreign Relations or at the United Nations General Assembly, but at the Grand Ballroom of the Mirage, it was a bomb.